From the beginning of life, the word and its derivation has reference to the birth or beginning of existence, so that the word here translated youth comprehends not only what we in English most commonly call the time of youth, but also childhood and infancy. So see here in Genesis 8:21, this is talking about humanity, how it's talked of as unrighteous even from infancy, even from its youngest days. And God knows that. He understands that the intentions, the imaginations, the inclination, whatever word or term you want to use there, of man's heart is evil even from youth, or as Edwards would say, even from infancy. So we have Scripture telling us that we're born into sin. Scripture is telling us we're unrighteous from infancy, but humanity is often described, even in general terms, as unrighteous. Humans are sinners by nature. Now, let me stop, and I'm going to do this from time to time, but I just want to point out that this statement, by nature, is extremely important to the doctrine of original sin. And defining what by nature means is vital in understanding the doctrine in the way that someone who believes it wants it to be understood. So I just want to make note of that, that there's a very restrictive sense in which by nature is used, this kind of created nature. This is just the way you are. It's how you're created. It's just by nature what you've become. And humans are sinners by nature. And there are a few passages appealed to along these lines. Ephesians chapter 2:2-3. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. So you see, by nature, we are children of wrath, Paul says. It's just what our nature is. It's just the way we're created. We're just inclined toward evil, the writer of Genesis tells us. And now Paul doubles up on that and just says, oh, we are by nature children of wrath. Psalmist has more to say in Psalm 14:2-3. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Pretty bleak picture of human existence. And of course, Paul quotes this in Romans, the third chapter as well, talking about the plight of humanity and where we find ourselves, that there's none who does good, no, not even one. I'm moving very quickly here. I understand that. I want to get through these passages, and I want to come back to them here in just a second and maybe try to look at them from a different perspective. But here's yet one more from Job 15:14-16. What is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of woman that he should be righteous? Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is detestable and corrupt. That's those babies right there, detestable, corrupt, because they're humans. Man who drinks iniquity like water. Calvinism is experiencing somewhat of a resurgence in our society. I think mostly to do with some major hits it's taken in past years, from some ideas and thoughts that we're not going to get into this morning, especially regarding the way Paul is viewed in the book of Romans and the book of Galatians, that I think viewed properly undermines quite a bit of what Calvinism tries to teach. But in a response to that and in reaction to that, there is almost an evangelical type of appeal toward this. There's an evangelism that the Reform movement is going under, trying to convince their children again about the ideas of Calvinism. And so now it is beginning to resurge, and it's already present in so much of what is said within religious circles. And the way that people think, you just go read some books about parenting, and almost every single one of them begins the book with this idea of the sinful nature of children. And a lot of what's in those books I agree with in terms of parenting ideas and concepts. It's just the foundation that's wrong. But it appeals to these types of verses, these types of ideas that children are just corrupt. You know, they're foolish in their hearts, and so that means they're sinful. And there's all these ideas, and that's just one element of where this goes. But the idea of Calvinism, particularly this idea of original sin, it pops up in various places and in various ways. And so I want us to think through some of these ideas, and here's one of these weak arguments, that infants die, so they are sinners. And typically there's an appeal to some passage like Ezekiel 18:4, the soul who sins shall die. So because death is experienced, that must mean they are not innocent. That must mean they are sinners. In fact, that is in the article written by Matt Pearman, one of the arguments he makes, which I just find to be fairly pathetic. Excuse my language on that. It's a horrible, horrible doctrine and belief to promote something so vile as that. But let's address some of these ideas and talk for just a minute about interpretive problems with some of what's going on here. Now, again, those of you who are in that class, you may identify some of these things we've already talked about. And so that's why I would encourage coming to Sunday morning and Wednesday night Bible classes, because we discuss these kinds of things. And if you ever run into these kinds of questions with people from work or friends or family, it's good to have that kind of ammunition in your pocket, things that you've been studying and looking at in the various Bible classes that we offer. And so maybe you'll recognize some of the important elements of what goes into interpretation. And unfortunately, even though some of these men are well-studied, like Ryrie, some of the problems that show up in what they say, the first of these, and we're going to encounter all of these as I go back through some of these arguments, is just not considering genre, the type of writing that we're looking at, and considering what that type of writing is for. The other is just flat-out ignoring context. It's what we often call proof texting. And it's not just people who want to teach original sin who struggle with this. We struggle with this. Many people struggle with this. Just pulling some verse from somewhere that seems to agree with what I already think and then pushing that forward as some kind of proof or evidence that what I already think is correct. There is that kind of problem what's going on in some of these arguments. So we have to ask some questions. Who's in the conversation? Who's being discussed? What is the issue at hand? What is this document really being written for or written about? And then there is the interpretive problem of stretching a vague text, taking a text that's not very clear, and promoting an idea or interpretation on it that actually disagrees with a clearer text, with a text that is very clear and obvious. All of this happens in some of the information I just fed to you very quickly from this doctrine of original sin. So are we really born in sin? Is it really as straightforward as all that information I just gave you in the past few minutes? Are there any answers to people who are going to promote this type of doctrine and this type of teaching? I would say yes, there are, if we're careful about how we interpret many of these passages and we think through them and observe some really important details about what's actually happening, even in the verses that they are using. Now, here's another interpretive thing to think about. When someone asks you a question, when someone is pulling something from the text, the first place to go is the text they're using. So I want to try to do that this morning. Now, there may be times it's appropriate to go somewhere else and look at something else, but I am convinced that most often we can sit right in the text they're using and think through that text alone and ask some good questions. Present maybe some difficulties to some things that we maybe are on our radar because if we've read Scripture and we've looked at Scripture, we just think that doesn't seem right. So let's think, let's observe, let's ask some good questions here. So let's talk about this key verse. The keystone verse of original sin, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." The first problem with this verse is that it's poetry. It's a genre issue. And it is a very bad idea to try to make rules of doctrine based on poetry. Because poetry is not literal very often. It is metaphorical. It is figurative. It is hyperbolic so often. And so to take a verse, and really this is the only one that actually says this idea, and we'll talk some more about whether it actually says it or not, but in the certain translations or the way it's viewed, it is the only verse that really promotes this idea in what seems to be a literal way. "I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." None of the other verses we looked at actually really deals with the idea that Scripture says we are born sinners. It deals with other things, that humans are unrighteous, or by nature, or by the quality of their life and the decisions they make, they are unrighteous before God. And so it proves some other things. Generally speaking, humans are sinful. Humans are corrupt, and that's what's going on in Romans 3 and in Psalm 14 in that section. But the only verse that really says this clearly is right here in Psalm 51 and verse 5. And so it needs to be talked about. It needs to be addressed. But I would suggest to you that as we do that, again, we just kind of observe the text itself. we look at the verses surrounding what is said here. For example, I know my transgressions, this is verse 3, and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Now let me ask you something about this text from Psalm 51, if we're going to take this literally and start establishing doctrine by what David is saying here. So David killed a man. He killed Uriah. He slept with Uriah's wife and got her pregnant. He forced the servants within the palace to lie, or at least deceive, those around him to make it seem better than it actually was. And you're telling me that David is going to say, against you, you only have I sinned? Did he not sin against Uriah? Did he not sin against Bathsheba in essentially forcing her, I believe, to do what he did with her? Did he not sin against the servants in the palace who he told he had to go get? They had to go get her and bring her back to the palace and then try to hide this away and then get Uriah drunk and get him out of the palace so he doesn't know what's going on, so that then he would come to his wife and he could blame this all on Uriah and say that he got her pregnant, and all the scheming and corruption and deceit? Are we saying that David only sinned against God? Because that's what he says here. Poetry, ladies and gentlemen. It's hyperbolic. It's not meant to be taken literally. He's expressing how vile his sin against God was, that in this moment he is perceiving it as this great violation and sin against God. Not at all trying to obscure the sins he committed against others, but right here as he's speaking to God, he's saying, I sinned against you and you only. It's emphasis. He's adding emphasis to the statement he's making, because that's what you do in poetry. It's not bound by literalness of prose. It is meant to express emotion. It is meant to use these types of add-ons and emphasis to accentuate the point that is trying to be made. Or even before that, my sin is ever before me. Now, maybe it's true that in David's life, this was just always going to be before him. I know some bad things that have happened in my life. I know some of the sins that I've committed in my life. And those things, I think about those things, but I don't think I would literally say they are ever before me. All the time, that's all I'm ever thinking about. That's the only thing that's ever in my mind. You see the problem here? We can come up with all kinds of theories and ideas and doctrines if we take something like poetry and we try to make it literal. That's only one half of the problem. Now we look at the other part of this, and the reality is the person that is actually in sin isn't even clear in the text. Is it saying that David was sinful when he was brought forth? Is it saying that David was sinful when he was conceived in the womb? Or is it saying that he was brought forth into iniquity, into a sinful world, that he was conceived in sin? Did my mother conceive me? Is this something that's going on in how he was conceived by his mother? Probably not. Again, I think it's just hyperbole. It's just the way he's expressing how sinful he feels before God. But the key verse, the one verse that really promotes this idea in its fullest way, is just vague and unclear in every turn and in every way. From every angle and every aspect, it is not clear what's actually going on here. Other than to say this is poetic, it's hyperbolic, he's expressing the vileness he feels in his heart toward God. And then he goes on to ask him to purge him with hyssop and be clean. Wash me, I'll be whiter than snow, using all kinds of other metaphors and imagery throughout this text. And you can read it yourself all the way through, and you get that idea. You see what's happening here in the words of David, the sin with Bathsheba, and the reality of the sin that's before him, and how he's presenting this to God, and his need to be cleansed, to be righteous before God again. So we need to understand the genre, the context of what's going on in these texts. Are we really unrighteous from infancy? Well, there's this verse in Proverbs 22:15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. I would suggest that folly isn't necessarily sin on a number of levels. We can do some things that are foolish that are not necessarily sinful. Not too long ago, Titus got a drone for the holidays. And it would be really foolish, I think, if he just threw that thing straight up in the air and just let go of the controls and just let it crash and break. That'd be kind of a foolish decision. I don't think that's sinful, though. And children do lots of things like that, things they haven't thought through clearly, things that may be considered kind of foolish or foolhardy because they don't know yet, which is something we'll come back to here in a little bit. But even beyond that, let's just think again about the context. Rather than just isolating and getting one idea that we want from it, let's think about the context of what's going on here. Is the wise man in Proverbs really talking about an infant here, a newborn baby that's born into sin? And so the way we take care of that is we use the rod of discipline on that infant, that newborn. Now, I believe in corrective actions happening pretty early in life. But I'm fairly certain in this context that the wise man is not talking about spanking a baby, a newborn, an infant, with the rod of discipline. And so what I'm asking us to do is just ask some questions. Just think through these texts. Consider what's actually being said here. And is this really promoting what sometimes people say it's promoting? What about this idea of inclination, this evil from youth, which Jonathan Edwards talked about has to do with infancy, or could have to do with infancy? I think what's actually more important than this, we talked about word studies in that class we did, and I think this is really a horrible word study by Jonathan Edwards. And if you want some more information on that, I'll be glad to share that with you later. Of the 46 uses in the Old Testament of this term, the only one that possibly has to do with infancy is in Job 31:18. That's it. In Job 31:18, it talks about him from being a youth, he was a father to the fatherless. And it uses a parallel expression about him helping the widow from his mother's womb. So what would you say about this passage from Job 31? Is it literal? Was he really helping people from his mother's womb? Was he really a father to the orphan in his infancy? Or is he trying to express an idea about his righteousness before God? About his standing before God? In fact, if this literally means infant here, this should be worth considering. If this really means infant, it actually exposes the exact opposite of original sin. That from his mother's womb, he was helping the widow. He was acting uprightly. That as a youth, as an infant, he was a father to the fatherless. I'm not sure how that would work, literally. But if that's actually what's happening, it is the exact opposite of what's being said in the doctrine of original sin. And then I just have to ask, if we think about Genesis 6:5, which I think is actually a more important concept in relation to some wording, it says something very similar. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination or intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. It's the same term. Same term used here in Genesis 6 as is used here in Genesis 8. That inclination is evil from his youth. I think it's a stronger consideration in paralleling these two terms and then asking, when God was looking down on earth, was he really looking at infants with evil thoughts in their hearts? Is that what this passage is about? Context. Right, looking at the big picture, seeing what's actually going on in the text is very important. This term he speaks of from its derivation has to do with infancy. Actually, it's interesting. The word derivation has to do with drawing fluid like pus and blood. So then we would assume by Jonathan Edwards' comment that that's what he's talking about in his statement. The derivation of this word, it's about flowing liquid, right? That's absurd. Derivation, etymology, does not mean the word means that. Just because somewhere in some place that word can have to do with infancy doesn't mean that is the right translation or concept in Genesis 8:21. What's much more important, again, is that we look at Genesis 6:5. We see the story within its context and realize that God is looking down on people making decisions, people who are wicked, people who are deciding to go against his will, people who have imaginations of thoughts in their heart that are evil. I have a very hard time thinking that is a newborn, that is an infant who is having these imaginations of evil thoughts in its heart. It doesn't really seem to be what God is dealing with there. What about this idea of being sinful by nature? And you were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you formerly walked. You just, even in my highlighting, you can just notice if you look at this text from a little bit different perspective. How many newborns do we know out there that are walking? Anyone ever seen a newborn walk? Action is implied by the statements made in these texts. Whether it's a thought of the mind or it's physical action, it is implied by the metaphor that is used, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Is there a spirit working in that newborn, in that infant, making it a son of disobedience? Is that newborn, is that infant, is it living in lust? Is it indulging the desires of the flesh? Is it indulging the desires of the mind? Because that's what it means to, by nature, be a child of wrath. Now, I know children, older children, can make some bad decisions. I don't think I've ever seen a newborn that was walking in the lust of the flesh or indulging the desires of the mind. I just want us to stop for a second and consider the passages that are being used to promote this idea. Because in these various articles, they said, well, this is the most biblical way to view this. And throwing up passages like Ephesians 2, 2 and 3. I just want us to think. I want us to ask some questions. And say, is this really supporting what people are saying that it's supporting? And there are some pretty big challenges to some of these thoughts. Now, first of all, nature doesn't always mean created nature. And that's part of the problem with this whole by nature sort of thing. In fact, Greek philosophers use this all the time just to talk about how the way things are. I think Paul does this as well in a couple places within the New Testament. He's not talking about created nature. He's just talking about the way things are. In our world, in our society, when things happen a certain way, that's just the nature of them. Just the way they are. It doesn't mean that's how they've always been or how they will always be. There's a very limited concept of what by nature means from an original sin perspective. But even if you accept that, there are some big challenges. You can't have two texts that are disagreeing, that are contradicting each other. So let's talk about Romans 2. How do we explain Romans chapter 2, 13 through 15? Romans 2, 13 through 15. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves. Even though they do not have the law, they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. Man, they're by nature doing the works of the law. How can someone who's by nature a child of wrath, by nature, do the works of the law and excuse themselves before God and be justified? There's some problems there. Or what about Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 29? God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. God made man upright. That doesn't jive very well with the idea that he made us corrupt. Or he made us by nature sinners. And what about this text from Psalm 14 that the Lord has looked down from heaven and everyone he sees, no one understands, no one seeks God. They've all turned aside or all become corrupt. Let's think about those phrases for just a minute. If you are by nature a sinner and you are born into sin, how do you turn aside? How do you become corrupt when you're already corrupt? When you're already totally depraved from birth, from the womb even, from conception? How do you then somehow become corrupt when you're already corrupt? Well, I have some answers to this. I would say maybe we should look at the context of the psalm and think about who's actually being talked about, whether it's in Romans 3 or in Psalm 14. That would be a good thing to do with interpretation, is look at the actual context. And the way this psalm starts is, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Anyone ever heard a newborn or infant speak? Anyone? I didn't think that would happen. I don't see a lot of infants saying there is no God, or really saying anything at all, actually. And so here's the context of this. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. Verse 4. Have they no knowledge, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? There they are in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. This is talking about people who have knowledge. Do they not have knowledge that he expects they would know? Do they not know what's going to happen with the Lord of all the earth, the Creator? I've never known a newborn or infant who would be expected to have that type of knowledge. This is the context of Psalm 14, the context of Romans 3, in which he's talking about these are mature people who are able to make moral choices. How many infants or newborns are able to seek after God? Again, just some big, big, big problems with using every single one of these texts that we've looked at so far. The logic does not line up. The interpretive methodology does not line up. The concepts do not work. And let's think about Isaiah 7, a text that we often use for various other things, but I want us to think about what's actually said here about this boy who is prophesied as going to come as a sign. This woman, the virgin, the maiden, is going to conceive and bear a son. And his name is going to be called Emmanuel. And there's a whole context to this that we're not going to get into, but that's the actual point of this passage. So I want to point that out first. This is about God being with us for good or for evil. That God is there, he is present. And that may mean good things for you, but it also could mean bad things for you. That's where this text ultimately goes. It could be reward, and it can be judgment. But notice the nature of how this is going to work in verse 15. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. Song here about Syria and Samaria. That Ahaz is afraid of these two kings. He says, this is going to be a sign to you. This child is going to be born. Before this child knows how to choose good or refuse evil, these two nations are not going to be a concern to you anymore. I know this passage has to do with something completely different, but we have to think about that phrase there, about the ability to choose good and refuse evil. What does that mean? I understand. We're not going to have the time to get into this morning, that a Calvinist is to say, well, at some point, you know, they're going to recognize that they have a sinful, corrupt being, and they didn't know that before, and so looking back, they realize, listen, it says they know how to choose good and refuse evil at a certain age. And we can try to toy with it and manipulate it and twist it and turn it, just like all these other passages we've looked at this morning, but it still doesn't change what it means in the context of the passage. And so I just want to encourage us to be very careful in our own reasoning, in our own logic, the way we use text, because this is just a poster child for proof texting right here in Job 15. This shows you how horrible proof texting goes. This text from Job 15, man, it sounds really good, right? What is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of woman, kind of abusing that phrase a little bit there. That's just someone who is a human, not really talking about infants so much. That he should be righteous. Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who's detestable and corrupt, man who drinks iniquity like water? There's lots of questions we could ask. Are infants drinking iniquity like water? Probably not. And that's kind of the context here of Eliphaz's statement. I don't know about you, but I don't want to take my doctrine from Eliphaz. The Lord said to Eliphaz, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. This is how badly proof texting can go, brothers and sisters. We take a phrase we like or that looks good and promotes what we already believe and already think. And we try to push it as if it's teaching truth, only to find out this is actually someone who is speaking error, and God recognizes it 11 chapters later. And so sometimes these texts, they seem very convincing. And the guy on that podcast or on the radio or the sermon you're listening to or the book you're reading, he's going to artfully present it in a way that is persuasive and that sounds really good. But we got to stop. We got to slow down. We got to ask good questions. What about this text from Ezekiel 18? Interesting. The soul who sins shall die. So, you know, death, that just means that someone, they must be corrupt, right? They must be sinful. Part of the problem here is we're missing the whole context of what's actually happening. Again, if we actually understand what's going on in Ezekiel 18, we read this text fully, we'll see it is actually kind of a hit to original sin. Our fathers eat the sour grapes and our teeth are set on edge, the people say. You know what they're saying? We're inheriting our parents' sins. You know, our parents sin and now we're getting the judgment for it. Now we're dying because of what our parents did, right? You know, our parents sinned, and so now without a sin, that sin that's coming on us, and now we're being judged for that. That's the context of this statement. And he says, no, you're dying for your own sins. I'm sending Babylon to bring death and destruction and exile on you because you have sinned against me. Not because of what your fathers did. It's because you are sinful and you have defied. And here's the reality about death. We're all going to die. And there's a whole thing we could go into here from Romans 5 about Adam and his sin and setting death in motion and all of that. And that would be something for a later sermon. But the reality is we are in a corrupt world, a corrupt existence. We are not incorruptible. You take this kind of from an amoral standpoint. Our bodies decay. And unless Jesus just comes again before it is our time, we're all going to die whether or not we are saved eternally. Is inconsequential. This body in this world, unless Jesus comes first, is going to end. That is not a sign that someone is in sin. And it is just a misuse and an abuse of a text like Ezekiel 18 to make such a point. The reality is this is actually about the nation of Israel. And that the sinful people within it are going to be judged. And if someone turns and becomes righteous, they will be delivered. Just read the whole text, the whole chapter. It goes in depth on this. But maybe a good place to end here is just talking about what Jesus has to say about this. Jesus says that we should become like children if we want to enter the kingdom of heaven. Twice within close proximity in the Gospel of Matthew and Mark as well, he has something to say about this. In fact, one time the disciples are trying to restrict the children. And he says, no, let them come to me. Truly, I say to you, unless you turn, unless you change, right? Because you turned aside, but now you need to turn back. Unless you turn to become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Let the children come to me. Do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. These are the words of Jesus, the Messiah himself. And maybe we should just think about the nature of God and who he is and what he is. The end of creation, this is what he said. God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good. Very good. Now that matches up with Ecclesiastes 7, that God made man upright. And then man went after schemes and ploys and sin. But what I know about God is that God makes things good. And that these babies are not sinners. That these babies are created in the image of God. And at some point, they will know to choose good. And to refuse evil. And at that point, it comes down to the choice they make. Whether they will choose God and his ways, or whether they will choose to follow the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that works in the sons of disobedience, among whom some of the Ephesians even once walked, but then they changed. They were raised up. By the grace of God, they were saved through faith. And so those babies and all the babies out here will all have that choice to make one day in their life. When they get to the point where they're able to decide what is good and what is evil. And all of us have that choice, even today, to choose what is good and to refuse what is evil, to do things the Lord's way or to do things my own way. We have that choice right now. He has given us the ability to choose if we love him and want to follow him. Do you want to do that this morning? Do you want to come to Jesus Christ and give your life to him? He tells you you can do that. You take up your cross and you follow after him. You deny yourself. And if you wish to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you'll lose your life for his sake, you will find it. And Paul tells us how we go through that process. We understand the way justification works. It comes through the blood of Jesus Christ, and that we are baptized into Christ, that we're buried into his death, and we come up out of the water in newness of life. As instruments of righteousness in the Lord's army. That's the concept, the idea in Romans 6. Do you need to do that this morning? Why don't you make that choice right now as we stand and we sing together.